The Rural Health Voice, episode 114, Health Literacy. Welcome to The Rural Health Voice. I am Beth O'Connor, your host. We discuss rural health issues at the grassroots level and how state and federal policies play out in our local communities. Who is responsible for health literacy? Systems design coach Stephen Ragsdale joined me to discuss how health disparities need to be addressed at every level. Well, Stephen.
Hi, Beth. Nice to see you. Nice to hear from you.
Nice to hear from you, too. And I was looking at some of your background information. You describe yourself as a systems design coach. What's a systems design coach?
These are folks who go in, who understand that most things are made up of systems, either organized or culturally based systems, right? Things that just kind of evolve out of the ether. And once you begin to kind of like understand that there's a thread, it becomes a through line in how you solve for problems. It becomes less about like our individual behavior and more about how things work within the system. I always tell people, like, if you think in terms of the human body is a system. And what happens when it's not working well? It's feverish, things don't work right. What is your body telling you? Your body is telling you to purge whatever that is bad. And so one of the things that we do in systems world is begin to kind of like take a look at, in particular from a historical standpoint, and unpack what got built into systems.
And you are also a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant. What types of groups or organizations do you work with?
I mostly started working with educational institutions because I was literally, this kind of thinking was on the vanguard, and that's usually the only space that, you know, I was afforded a voice, mostly in the classroom. And I started out mostly in the healthcare space and community health, particularly in the nursing sphere and medical schools, and in particular around schools of public health. Having a background in history, again, and in systems, one of the things that I think went unacknowledged for a really long time was how much was baked into our systems and whether or not they were harmful or helpful, you know, in particular to various groups of people, various populations. And so now we're beginning to evolve that understanding. So I started working with educational institutions, but now I have moved into a community group in Southern Maryland that is made up of a few churches, the local library systems from three different counties, the NAACP from three different counties, and they've all come together to create what they call the big conversation around how diversity can work to, and diversity, equity, inclusion can work to community benefit. That's been extraordinarily interesting work. I started this work on the policy sphere. I helped to craft legislation in Maryland in the 90s. Some of the first health equity legislation in the country. I think New Jersey was the first state to pass legislation, state-based legislation around what education should look like in the health equity space. And we were some of the first folks to put pen to paper to, you know, to create a framework for having, not only having a discussion, but how we evolve education, how we begin to democratize what it is that we've learned through evaluating these systems. And so that's been extraordinarily interesting work. So I've worked with a couple of state work groups down in Annapolis to evolve this discussion. I've worked with, again, Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, done some work out in Illinois. I've worked with affinity groups that look at maternal and child health, groups that are interested in educational equity. I do a lot. So I've lectured at professional schools of education, the law, social work, and even the Art Institute of Maryland. Waking up every day and doing my work is fun and interesting. I answer the phone to whomever calls. in particular if the conversation is in the good and, you know, create a dialogue that helps us better understand how to do systematic work around diversity, equity, and inclusion.
What's your favorite part of being a DEI consultant?
This is self-proclaimed. I've been told that I'm kind of like naturally gifted at sharing the message, so teaching. I often get called in to do some consulting work at all levels, especially like to go into C-suites, you know, and have this conversation, you know, because of the diversity in there. First off, professional diversity, because they're all aiming in seemingly different directions, but in a collective. And so when you start talking about like what DEI looks like framed from a systemic standpoint, ooh, you know, those conversations are very interesting right from the beginning. And as we begin to unpack like what's happening systematically and what our framing is, and when I talk about our framing, like how we have been taught as a collective to deal with these issues at work and in play, comes into play. And then we have a conversation and it's like, well, now that we know that this is the way that we, you know, that we built this into the frame, and now that we know that this is how we've been trained to look at it, one, what's our responsibility to it economically? And then two, like, how do we solve for it? How do we begin to evolve solutions around creating diversity, equity, and inclusion in spaces that is, like, again, profitable for everyone. Oh, and a finer point, I think one of the things that we've been mistrained around is when you do diversity, equity, and inclusion, that there are groups who lose. And that's never been my framing around diversity, equity, inclusion. I've always kind of looked at diversity, equity, inclusion as an economic problem, that you're not using your resources efficiently. And when you start dividing up your care apparatus or your business line in any way, where you are creating queue lines for some people that are longer than others, this is just inefficient modeling. And one of the things that I have taken joy in showing people that if you break down some of these barriers, that you actually get to grow the pie, that the pie, nobody is losing, that you're actually, you know, this is a way of winning. This is winning. But because of the fixed mindset that we've had around diversity, equity, inclusion, you know, I often have to remind folk that that's not our frame. Equity is not our starting point. It's never been our starting point. So learning how to apply it so that it works is new muscle development for us as a society.
And I first met you at the Movement is Life Summit. This is an event which brings people together to discuss how we can take action to eliminate racial, ethnic, and gender disparities in health. What ideas do you have for action?
Oh, boy, this is going to sound cliche, but I think the first place, and again, this is, and it's also self-serving, that, you know, I did my graduate work in this space. I do not know how we become solution-oriented in this space until we re-educate ourselves on what is causing us this kind of economic duress. We don't know what we don't know. My mom worked as a 911 operator for 30-some-odd years for the local police department. And I would always ask her, well, how did you, you know, she was offered the job as a trainer. I was like, how did you train your job? Well, the person who sat beside me taught me how to do X, Y, and Z. And I said, okay, real time. I said, Mom, how did they do dispatch a 911 in 1950? What was important to them way back then? You know, she would look at me, you know. First off, I've always been a kind of a smarter kid, so that kind of question didn't really stun her. And she would actually give it some thought. And she's like, okay, yeah, really, you know, she. But it gave her a construct around how it is that we learn our systems. Institutional capacity is often lost, you know, as you transition and evolve these systems. And sometimes we don't know why we did the good. And sometimes we don't know the intended bad was planted in the first place. And so you can't evolve a solution around old construct without understanding what the old construct was in the beginning. And so I started out like, girl, we really need to be able to educate ourselves around why it is that we organize our systems in the way that we do, in particular around healthcare. And what does it say about our value propositions to humanity? You know, how we value one another. That's the starting point. But there's a whole lot of things that kind of come after that.
So if we just keep doing things the same way we've always been doing it, because that's the way we've always done it, are we going to make any real progress?
I mean, and that's kind of what you see, like as a historian, that's what you see over the last 100 years of medical history, you know, 150 years of medical history. There are fits and starts, and we go forward for a little while, and then, you know, there's often a backlash. And the backlash is not only sociological, but economic. It's retrenchment of systems. It is a withdrawal of funds. I happened to be working in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s, when AIDS and HIV became a public health nightmare. But because of the politics, the science wasn't addressed. That's how social systems impact some of our public systems.
Well, at the Movement is Life Summit, you said something during a breakout session that motivated me to walk over and introduce myself. You said, health literacy goes both ways. Tell me what you meant by that.
My starting point is my wife is a person who speaks Spanish and Portuguese fluently. You often, when we go to different countries, people want to know what Spanish-speaking country she's from. And my wife is from the other side of town. Like, we grew up not far from one another. But her ability to communicate specifically to different, like, dialect matters. You know, all that stuff matters, right? And so literacy is a communication of what, you know, reading and writing and how you communicate. And one of the things that I found a little jarring when health literacy hopped on the scene was this idea that professionals determine what it meant to be health literate. And particularly in this country, knowing the history that I know about, like, indigenous contributions to medicine and African contributions to medicine and contributions to medicine from the Scottish Hills, people who, again, have been considered one down groups. You know, and this idea that the people who had actually created some of the better foundations of medicine were now, their descendants were now seen as illiterate, just was a little jarring to me. The second thing that jarred me about that is we were talking about patients, if you will, and this idea that the consumer, the patient, was illiterate. You know, made me ask the question, what's the responsibility of the professional to be literate as well? So I always ask a bimodal question. Again, as a historian, you know, you ask questions in law school training. You ask questions two or three different ways, two or three different times. And my idea was this idea that literacy was being driven, like, out of institutions with these mandates about, like, how, learning how to read, what it is that professionals do, instead of, like, kind of right-sizing it to the population. So this was at the beginning of the health literacy conversation. And so, like, again, as I listen to it and I watch health care or health in particular model itself around creating a literacy model, in a lot of ways they were insulted because I was like, depending on who you're talking to. So what does it mean for a man to be health literate in family medicine as a consumer? I mean, so like literacy was starting to cut in the ways that, like, again, was only focus on, like, literally what I consider one down groups, you know, minority populations and their responsibility to the marketplace. And I was like, no, I don't think that that's the only way that we should be looking at it. I think that when you practice in an area, when you are a professional in an area and you have professional expertise, it is your responsibility also to be literate in the spaces that you are treating. So health literacy, for me, and again, this is my evolution. I didn't start out this way. I was on the road of, oh, no, you need to know how to read food labels. You got to know how to talk to your doctor. You know, again, but as a hospitalist, I was originally down that road. But as I moved out into community and began to have conversations with what, you know, it's like, wait a minute. One, the professionals aren't really listening. They are driving literacy through their lens. And that can't be good. And so that's where my thinking around health literacy starts, right? You know, as a hospitalist. But again, like when you're doing community health and you watch the adverse effects of the gaps in communication in between the consumer and the provider, you got to think it's multifactorial and it's not always on the patient.
Over the years, I have seen grant opportunities devote millions of dollars to the concept of health literacy in terms of making sure the individual receiving health services has the ability to understand health information. But I have never seen a grant addressing the ability of an individual organization providing services to understand the situation of the individual receiving these services. Those funding things are one way. I have seen grants and outreach programs refer to cultural competency, which is defined as the ability of healthcare providers or organization to understand and respond to the cultural needs of their community. Is that just a different kind of health literacy? Are we arguing semantics?
Well, I mean, so it is semantics, but I like words. And so like, let's play with the words a little bit. Cultural competency, again, like I started out in that space because we as individuals are multifactorial beings. If I look at you, you know, I can tell what you are by what it is that I see, what I can actually lay eyes on. But you as a cultural being are much more than what I see. You know, you have a background, history of where you come from. Right? Your geography, your religion, there's a whole lot of factors that play into that. And I think that one of the things that the mistake, thinking that we could become culturally competent beings, is there's way too much to understand and know about culture in order to become competent. I think it was a failed attempt in a lot of ways to get to a good place. But I've evolved to a different place. Rarely use the word culturally competent these days. I use cultural dexterity. So it's able to be fluid and move and fit yourself into these cracks so that you can create better understanding. My undergrad is in Latin American history. I've traveled Central and Southern. And I still like, you know, many, many, many years removed. I would not say that I'm a culturally competent being when I'm in a lot of spaces in Latin America, because Latin America is so vast and it's so many different cultures. And so to be call myself culturally competent, you can be culturally dexterous in a house, culturally dexterous in a block, culturally dexterous in a neighborhood. But developing cultural competency in all of those places, I think, is pretty hard.
Whether we call it health literacy or cultural competency or cultural dexterity, how much does it matter in the healthcare world? If I have high blood pressure and you are a physician prescribing my medications, what difference does it make in terms of cultural competency?
Well, again, I may use the word cultural dexterity. And the reason I'm going to use cultural dexterity because I think health and how you receive health, is, again, first off, it's an economic proposition. Money is changing hands for care or treatment in some ways. Now, if you come from a different place, we cannot treat care, and we never have, I mean, we haven't for a long time, as though it is a monolith, that everywhere you go, those algorithms work. Sometimes you need to intervene on an algorithm in order to make it, again, culturally dexterous. if you are in a neighborhood that is a food desert and you are your primary care doctor and all you're talking to your patients about is eating 5 fresh fruits and vegetables a day, when there are no fresh fruits and vegetables for miles, how do you have a culturally dexterous conversation to do what happens next? What is the next proposed solution? And up until really recently, a new phenomenon, I think that in particular, medicine has never been driven to kind of solve it for that. When you are not doing wellness care and you're treating disease and sickness, that's how you organize your care paradigm.
Because if I don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, if I don't have access to clean water, if I don't have a place where I can exercise, your advice doesn't mean much of anything.
The other thing is the physician is not economically incentive to do anything. I mean, to solve for your problems, because he's going to get paid, you know, or she's going to get paid. Your population statistics for your area, your system statistics are not going to change because they never change. But I think the thing that gets said most is the economic engine, not the community health benefit. Because you keep cycling in people with comorbidities.
Think about some of those systems. Because of the expense and education requirements of many positions in the healthcare field, most healthcare providers come from privileged backgrounds. What do you think can and should be done to improve how they relate to patients?
Well, the first thing that if you look at the American, what is this? AMC, American Association of Medical Colleges. Go look at their data. This fascinates me because the data is, again, historically significant and relevant. If you go back and you look at the Flexner Report, today, I think African-American women make up less than 1% of the physician population in America. But on the flip side, you see that as a population, also have some of the worst mom and baby statistics in some places, you know, our country looks like a third world. So for me, I was like, how the heck did this happen? And so I went back and looked at, well, what does it mean to become a doctor? Who created the formularies for becoming a doctor? So the people who you talked about originally actually created the formulary. They were in the 10th century, Abraham Flexner and a few physicians from some amazing academic medical institutions up and down the Eastern Seaboard who determined that proprietary medicine should no longer be a thing. And so who would be eligible? And so like, if you go back and you read the Flexner Report, the first, I think, 10, 12 chapters are literally about the hardline sciences, how you organize medicine. But the last two chapters are quite interesting because the last two chapters talk about Black men and white women as physicians. Black women are not even written into the report. There is no place for them written. To me, it makes sense that since 1910, we've only moved that group from 0 to 1%. And so the same thing with white women in the original Flexner Report would be allowed to attend medical school because there was a certain, I mean, some Victorian age country, but there's a lot of women who did not want men investigating their biology of a woman. And so the Flexner Report committed to that and said, you know what, there's a school up in Philadelphia educating, but only white women would receive this training. And the last group were African-American men. I think there were 7 or 8 African-American medical schools, mostly in the South, that closed. And I think the only schools left open after the Flexner Report were Howard University and Meharry Medical School. That's meaningful because the time the report comes out, there are 10 11 million black people live in the United States and 2 medical schools. Now, when you talk about concordance in care, cultural dexterity, creating care and understanding and putting it in places where it works best, well, we're way underwater. Because if you go and you look at the AAMC statistics, there are more than 22,000 medical school seats available every year. And I think it's less than 2,000 black people born in America filling those slots. And so when you start talking about population health and creating those lanes of understanding where you understand how a person lives, what contributes to their health paradigm, what should their best health economics look like, we're not building the capacity. Actually, in a lot of ways, we are building old systems to solve new problems.
Well, one of the lanes that VRHA has picked was addressing health literacy by promoting the concept that healthcare providers should reflect the patients that they serve. This means more Black and Hispanic clinicians, more rural clinicians, more LGBTQ plus clinicians. It even means more male nurses and more male dental hygienists. How can we increase the diversity among health profession students?
Two things. I'm going to put a pin in the first thing that you said, because I think that has improved. So when I first started doing this work on the community health, you know, particularly with nursing, I would walk into a room and there would be 250 white young women looking back at me. My rooms never look like that anymore. There's always, a dude. I mean, when I say a dude, I mean a military cat. He's sitting there buffed. just came back from somewhere across the seas, throwing bodies over his shoulders. So like when I talk about like the diversity of the room, the real diversity of the room, talk about the way that I see diversity. Remember when we talk about diversity, like not only what we see, but ideals, like different religions, different concepts. My mom just recently passed, different concepts of palliative care, what it means to leave this planet. We're not all culturally the same in that space. And when I say it's like, for real, you can imagine when I'm in the room, you know, creating a diversity wheel around what I want to see at the table. A lot of people might look exactly the same, and often do. But they are a really diverse set of people. And what I try to do is to try to leverage those things in them that we don't typically see. And so it may not be their race or their ethnicity or the language that they speak or their gender preference. It might be because they were an athlete, because cultures of athletes deal very differently than cultures of non-athletes. Might be a rural person instead of an urban person, because those lifestyles and the way that they lend and the way that they see their own lens, how they treat their own lens, is different. And so I'm always looking to broaden diversity, or how we use diversity in ways that I don't think people, the race, the ethnicity, the age, gender preference, and the language. Those are the easiest things.
They fit into nice little neat boxes that you can check off on a form.
That's exactly right. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen learning how to cook. I can make a decent meal. But one of the things that I had to learn was these things that I use in my food have different textures, different flavors, and when combined together, like so, my spaghetti sauce might taste a little different. Like, it's the same, but because of how much I use and how I sprinkle it in, I'm always trying to produce a better result. And that's how I think diversity should work. That's how I think equity should work. One of the things that I have to teach people is, so those categories that we created, those boxes that you talked about, one of the things that we have to do is have to figure out, like, well, why did we create those boxes? And then once people become unpinned, to those boxes, then you can do some real work. I hate when I hear people, European culture, majority culture, say, oh, I have nothing to contribute to this conversation. Oh, the hell you don't. Oh, you certainly do. You know what I mean? You know, oh, no, I'm a white cisgender male and nobody wants to hear. Oh, no, I want to hear what you got to say. Because what else do you do? You know, you play baseball, you know, what else do you do? Are those things that I see, is that only you? Is that your only representation? Is that the only thing that you bring to the party? And then when I began to interrogate people in that different way, then they began to understand that they find commonalities and bridges in places that they didn't anticipate. This is an old strategy. There's a woman who was running for Congress. I think she was running for something in Georgia, Stacey Abrams, who decided to go up into the hills and talk to people who were the hill people. She is from a city. She was talking to people who came from her station who did not look like her about issues that mattered to them, and they were shocked. And like, oh, we had something in common. I think that's when the pressure gets lowered and that's when world gets done. And I think that's when you get to grow again. This is when you get to grow the pie.
My last question I ask all my guests, if you could do anything, what would you do to improve health and healthcare in rural America?
I'm going to pre-qualify this because I spent my summers in a town in Virginia about an hour north of Durham, North Carolina, every summer with my grandparents. And so I had context for this conversation. One of the things that my wife and I benefited from were, you know, in particular, learning what we learned was we benefited from exchange programs. I'm a kid from East Baltimore. I was fortunate because my dad worked for Johns Hopkins University in the 50s all the way up into the 90s. So, you know, I wasn't the average ordinary bear. I got to see a little bit more than most. But nothing opened up my world like traveling to other countries and traveling to others. I've been fortunate. I've been to 40 different states in this country. And I've been to a lot of Central and South American countries. And my eyes are wide open when I go into these spaces. I don't speak the language well. I read Spanish really well. And I depend on my wife to get me out of trouble. But my ears are wide open. I spent the summer in Venezuela back in the late 90s. I would go at noon, at lunchtime, and sit and listen to old men talk about baseball. How did I know I was going to learn something about life listening to old men, you know, rap about baseball in Spanish? My grandfather played in the Negro League. Poorly word, I could always get into trouble, but I had somebody to talk to about something. And that drew some, you know. So exchanges, creating lanes of exchange where understanding can grow. And I think that you have to start that with people who are willing to listen, to have that exchange, and who are cool about disagreeing on some things. But I think that the other part of that is I think that benefits the parts that are not rural America. Because it's a symbiotic relationship. You don't give learning without learning something.
And I think those types of exchanges could help us understand, you know, what we contribute to each other without even realizing it.
What amazed me a long time ago is going to these Spanish-speaking countries and witnessing people who had very little or nothing and had better health care probability statistics than I did. They didn't have much of anything. And I was like, how the hell are they healthier than me? Now, you have to wrap your mind around that. And again, because of the systems that I grew up in, very different from the systems that they grew up in. You know, they had fresh fruits and vegetables, like, you know, in the neighborhood. like falling off the trees. You know, like, I mean, that's a different lifestyle than having to, you know, I mean, so, yeah, like, learning that those exchanges, I've been a lot of places, I've learned something great everywhere I've been.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Beth, for having me. This is Rural Out Voice. I'll be checking this out from now on. I love being here. My family dates back 14 generations of Virginia, both white and black. And so, like, being in this space with you at this time was meaningful. And I hope my father is looking down and is checking out the show.
Thank you. That's Stephen Ragsdale with his wish for cultural exchange. If you want to be part of the conversation about rural health, check out the National Rural Health Association's Health Equity Conference this May in New Orleans. Details are in the show notes. The Rural Health Voice is the podcast of the Virginia Rural Health Association. It is sponsored by the Virginia State Office of Rural Health and underwritten by the National Rural Health Association.